Today is Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist, spelled A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. Just fine, thanks.
Great. Glad to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, you left us last time, I believe, still in 1966, so correct me there if I'm wrong. And you'd been approached by Howard Mitchell of the Sierra Club to lead a highlighter trip for the club using pack animals into Kanab Canyon. Can you pick that thread up for me?
Yeah. And they were known as High Light, H-I-G-H-L-I-G-H-T.
Thank you.
High Light.
Okay.
And they had been run successfully in the High Sierra for many, many years. Was one of their first type of trip to really get lots of people up in the Sierra when it was not popular to go hiking. And the concept was that pack animals would carry the gear, well, all the gear, personal packs and food and kitchen. The group would hike.
Oh.
And they contracted with a packer, and the club provide a leader, two leaders, and a cook, and it developed into a moving trip that typically did one day of hiking and two nights at a camp, so you had a layover day to explore locally. Then you would move the camp again and have a layover day, sometimes two layover days. But it was a way to encourage people to get the experience and figure out that they could hike in the Sierra. This was what Mitchell wanted, was to have a trip down Kanab Canyon. I don't recall how he picked that. I'm pretty sure he came to Pipe Springs, which is where I lived then, because I had a couple things in the Sierra Club bulletin, or they may have said, I'm out there, check with me, I might know someone who does that, as far as outfitting the trip. And you had mentioned that they wanted me to lead the trip. No, this was to organize packers, because there was no pack station, no one up there did that. They were all cattlemen who ran cattle out on the Arizona Strip, and they all had pack animals because they had huge grazing allotments, hundreds of square miles, and you did it on horseback. And at the time, the Kanab Canyon and all of the western Grand Canyon west of the park still had active cattle permits, and just by default, the only way to get to the grazing on the slopes of Kanab Canyon, for example, up on the Esplanade, was to get in by horseback and with pack mules.
Okay.
I'm trying to think, all the cattlemen that I knew there at Moccasin had grazing down in Kanab Canyon. So it was just a fortuitous thing that Mitchell came to me, and I right away said, oh, yeah, I know a whole bunch of guys who would do that. And I volunteered to coordinate it because I knew none of the cowboys, they had real misgivings about taking 25 Californians down the canyon and what would show up, what they would be, how it was going to work and all of that. And I was able to be a good intermediary, and I went on the trip as a packer.
Alan, let's back up a little bit. What year was this?
I'm debating when this was, because I don't have I can't just whip out the dates. I have problems with remembering dates and people names.
Yeah, totally understood.
I remember a place vividly. I know every place we went, but it was 60, maybe 67.
Okay.
68 at the, not 68. Possibly it was in the spring.
So let's back up a little bit. You were released from service in January of 66. You went back to California. Got your gear, and then headed to the northern part of Grand Canyon, met John Riffey. When did you kind of set up shop at Pipe Creek?
Pipe Springs, National
sorry.
Monument.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of that because it could have been that same year in 64, maybe 65, at the latest.
Well, that would
one of those seasons, because I know I had had several individual exploratory pack trips into the Western Canyon, just getting more and more, learning more, and taking pictures.
Right.
The first trip down Kanab Canyon, I had the 8x10. And I know I took several other outings there that first year. And I wish I could just have a calendar and say, well, this was this date and this was that date. I can still eventually work something out like that if you want it.
I'm just thinking if you were discharged from the military in January of 66 and then that year in 66, that spring.
The Sierra Club trip was not that spring at all, because I was known, knew everybody, and they knew who I was and what a person I was for that first summer. I did get the job at Pipe Springs because I was camping at their campground. And I mentioned before that this was before the paved highway.
Right.
And it was just a dirt road through the monument and by the fort in the springs. And I got a job as an interpreter and as a park historian, and that and spent that summer season basically working for the park, but also right there to take off on my days off to explore the canyon.
Okay, so that was a seasonal park position then?
Yes.
Okay.
It was definitely seasonal. And I was able to earn it decent living, had a nice quarters there.
Ah.
A three-bedroom house.
Wow.
Because it was only me and the superintendent and a maintenance guy.
Okay.
So.
Who do you remember who the superintendent was at the time?
Unfortunately, Curtis was his name. And he had some real problems locally and with the park service, and mainly, I won't get into that. It was burning down brush in very sensitive areas.
Okay.
He would walk around with a box of matches, and the rest of us would follow him around and clean up the mess, the result. So, but that was...
Is that Gerdes?
Yes.
Okay. And was he a pyromaniac, or was he just trying to deal with a huge amount of tumbleweeds?
Both.
Okay.
We really debated and decided that he, had a problem. So, but we survived it. No buildings got burnt down, but...
Good. Do you remember?
I don't know if you want to emphasize that.
No, these are the real life problems that Park Service has to deal with day in, day out. Who was the maintenance person? Do you remember?
That was Joe Bolander, and that was a key thing too because he was from Orderville, Utah.
Okay.
Maybe 50 miles north of the border there, from a pioneer family, he was an older gentleman, very neat guy, knew the history of the area, was related to everyone in the area.
Oh, wow.
That's a key. I would underline that right there. And... he really appreciated that I, liked the history, and I did. And I was there to, take pictures of the landscape and the historic buildings. I end up taking a lot of pictures of historic buildings.
But, great.
Joe Bolander, and then...
So did you learn your history? I mean, as an interpreter, your job is to speak with the tourists that stop by, and park historian. You've got to get up to speed on that. I would think that someone like Joe would be really instrumental.
Well, he was. He answered, all the questions and directed me into areas that I needed to understand, and the whole history of the monument there was his relatives and that owned it for many years and sold it to the Park Service.
Okay.
And it was very, very instrumental. Also, there was a fellow my age, Mel Heaton, H-E-A-T-O-N, that worked at the park also, the monument there, occasionally in the summer. And he lived in Moccasin and was the real connection between me and the community up there. Because in the middle of the Paiute Reservation there were two private inholdings. There were actually prior holdings at Pipe Springs and at Moccasin. Pipe Springs was a national monument, so that was kind of in place. Up at Moccasin, it was settled by Mormon pioneers in the mid-60s, and at a set of very large springs. And these people, typical of the settlement there, they had a community. Were subsistent farmers, but they were cattlemen, and they grazed their cattle all across the Arizona Strip.
Okay.
And that whole area of the Arizona Strip was very rare to have cattlemen living out on the range. If you go Midwest or I imagine Montana, wherever you think of cattlemen, it's often, you know, the big ranch house and the family living out on the range, but not there. At Kanab and Fredonia and Pipe Springs, these were tight-knit communities that they were really cattlemen and had thousands of head of cows out on the range.
Okay. And then I'm going to jump in again at trying to keep to that specific time, your first season there at Pipe Springs. Did you make any connections at that time, that first summer with Paiute, with any of the Paiute people?
Yes and no. The first season was a difficult time for the Paiutes, and the main problem was the teenage boys were having a really rough go of it, and it wasn't gang violence, but the result was the same, because they'd often get into battles, fist fights and everything, but end up knifing each other. And you know, there was one of the boys rang the doorbell in my house in the middle of the night and collapsed in a pool of blood, but fortunately we got him to the hospital and he survived. But
great,
there was very serious concern about how they were doing themselves in.
Oh, my.
You know, the whole series of the alcohol, no real drugs, not the drugs we have today at all.
Uh-huh.
But just kind of a despair, I'd imagine, that it was, to me, if I had to describe it, I'd say a very sad time for the Paiutes.
Yeah,
and
wow.
But we did knew all the main families up there, just as I knew the Mormon families. Well, they were, I can't say that, because they were all Mormon, the Paiute and the Anglos is what we ended up calling each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Mormon ward in Moccasin, and there were maybe, I want to say, 40 people living there. So this is a small town, village.
Okay.
And out at the Paiute village, which was about a mile away, there were another 40 people. And they all came together for church. And they knew each other. Great, you know. So it was in later years that I developed a lot more contacts. And after I was married out there, and we definitely knew the Paiutes more, because my wife Sharon taught high school in Fredonia that all the kids were bused to, and she knew all the kids and all the parents, and so we had good relations with everybody out there.
Cool.
So,
okay, just a paint that picture of 1966 land you squarely in it.
Yeah.
And your role as a seasonal ranger there. Do you have any recollections of amount of visitation that summer of 66?
Lots of 18-wheeler trucks roaring through.
Okay.
And thank goodness by the summer was out, they had completed paving the highway about half mile south of the monument. So that was relieved. But the visitation was very small. I'd say, if 20 or 30 carloads of people came, stopped in, that was unusual.
Okay.
And I guess I'm saying after the highway, but everybody stopped at, when it drove right through the next to the fort. But, so there could have been 100 cars a day, because it was the main road from Kanab, Fredonia to, and the North Rim to points west.
Okay.
And through there. One point that turned out to be very important was, and you can, as an hour later, John Riffey's wife, Mary Beth, right?
Yep.
She was still teaching at the university in Washington State. And
okay.
She would come down for the summer, and she was, among other things, an ornithologist, and really jumped at the chance to do any bird research. And the first, and I was there at Pike Springs the second summer, but she conned me into doing a bird survey. And I say conned me because I like birds, but I really felt I was the last person she should be asking, but she knew what she wanted, because Pike Springs was perfect for her. It was wide open desert, 10 miles in each direction, and this huge oasis of all these green trees and orchards and ponds, two big water ponds out in front, and everything that flew by passed through Pipe Springs.
Oh, wow.
And so she had me, she made a hand-done map of the monument, which is just, what was it? Not even a, might have been a quarter section at the most, but and a hand-drawn map with all the, each tree and bunch of bushes and garden and pond and water and everything to delineate the place. And she mimeographed a whole copy of them. And every morning, for about half an hour, and I got real good at it, really, was to make a quick circuit of the monument, which was, you could do in half an hour, and mark with a coded system every bird species and male or female and where they were in the monument.
Okay.
And much to my amazement, I could do that. I learned, I was happy to learn all the birds.
Nice.
I had never stopped to really do that. And
did you see any unusual birds there migrating through?
Occasionally.
Okay.
There were some. all new and new data. She didn't know what
oh,
was true.
Right.
So everything was just to find out what was really there. And she did the same down at Torah Week. And every time she came or they came to the store or something, she'd come by and pick up the papers I had done, the maps, and hear some stories and encourage me some more. And fortunately, my boss encouraged this too, though I usually did it early in the morning before, just out of sunrise or after and before I went to work. But there were just an incredible number of birds there. They all congregated to that few acres. And it's where, and I bring it up because that's where I met, I had known Riffy. I had met him several times, but got to know Mary Beth and got to know him even more. He just welcomed me when I'd come down to his place there, and I want to know what's up, you know, what have I been doing?
Nice.
So I just add that in there.
Yeah. And so I just want to go back to Superintendent Gerdes for a minute. I'm assuming he was your boss and he encouraged
yeah.
you to do this. That's nice.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Mary Beth then? What how did she strike you? What were your thoughts?
She didn't surprise me. She had the same personality that Bond did. I was kind of surprised, you know, to learn that he was married and had a wife, and even though they had just gotten married just before I got there. But I had the picture of him as being this, you know, isolated, independent Rangers ranger, and the family life, it was perfect. They were a really great couple, and she was very academic, but also was able to deal with the locals out on the Arizona Strip, and that she was probably thankful to John Riffy for, because he had all these contacts that she never could have gotten, and
right.
I never could have gotten. And but I remember that time, and I don't know if you want to, I'll just mention two more things.
Yeah, please.
It could be the second summer, but that doesn't matter. It just happened for the story. The cattlemen were out on the range, and I shot a coyote, which they were wont to do, as, you know, it's just for their cattle sake. But the boys, a couple of the young boys that I would say were 8 or 9 years old, they then found where the den was in the side of a wash, and there were two baby coyotes in there. And boys being boys, they stuffed, took in their pockets and brought them home. And I guess the dads were not too happy about this. And one of them stopped by Pipe Springs and to show me this little coyote pup. And long story short, I ended up raising the coyote pup. And you definitely couldn't, you know, now there are laws against keeping wild animals and whole range of things. But
yes,
this pup, his eyes weren't open yet. I got a little baby bottle, and fortunately it would drink the milk, and within a few days it was eating some wet dog food. And I kept it in the house in a box with, you know, towel in the bottom, and would play with it quite a bit. And much to my surprise, Rusty grew up to be a young adult, and the whole experience was one of the major things for me there at Pipe Springs, because it changed, well, me personally, and then the whole attitude of the cattlemen around there. Some of them thought I was nuts, others got a respect for a different point of view, and right away, you know, I could feel the wildness of this animal, and I put him a box outside. He stayed outside. He was completely free to go anytime, anywhere, and he grew up, you know, to a good-sized coyote who was imprinted on me. So there's a fun experiences that I had, and there's a intense responsibility that you have when an animal's imprinted on you. Because he just did coyote things. He ran all over out in the desert. In fact, when I'd whistle, he'd come right up to me. He'd come in the quarters. I had to leave a door open, either the back kitchen door or the front door. And then he would just sit down with me. He'd play. He'd chase a ball. He'd sleep in my lap. But if I shut the door, he was racing around, leaping at the windows, and being, you know, really distressed.
Interesting.
But he was perfectly content. A humorous thing, well, two, and then we'll see. One is that I had to teach him to howl.
Really?
The Gertises had a little dog, an obnoxious little mutt, and the coyote and the dog ran around the monument harassing the squirrels and what have you. But the dog barked constantly, and Rusty started barking, but it didn't work. He really couldn't get it across how to bark like the dog. And so I took him down and one night, and when no one was around, I did my best coyote howl, and he just teamed right in. And it came out, and every evening, and more often, that when I felt like it and when it was time, part of his day, we'd have a howl. I'd sit down on the ground or on the step, and he'd come up and sit down, but lean up against me. And just the typical picture of you think of a coyote sitting there howling up at the moon. And he'd be leaning against my shoulder, and we'd howl together.
Wow.
And I then, the other thing was, up at, there wasn't a visitor center, there was a little travel trailer, very old one that was, well, it didn't have the wheels or axles, it was just sitting on the ground. It wasn't even 6 by 12 feet, and it was divided in half, and Curtis had a desk in the one half, and I had this little museum, and I made some exhibits for it. That was
park headquarters.
Yes.
My, okay. No wonder Curtis kind of wanted to burn things down. I don't blame him.
And the monument was actually under the jurisdiction of Zion Park superintendent.
Okay.
So Gerdes, though he was called the superintendent of Five Springs, he was definitely second to the guy at Zion.
Got it.
Along with that.
So Zion had the secretarial staff, did the managing, did the accounting.
Right.
And basically, Gerdes and you and Joe were the actual boots on the ground out there. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And during the day when I would be working, I noticed Rusty the Coyote would, you know, had routine where he'd go here, go there, but then he would kind of settle down under one of the sage brushes right next to the little trailer museum there, visitor center, where people came in. Everyone stopped there before going to the fort. And some people would come by and some of them knew, and they were kind of hesitant and said, "Well, we kind of hear you have a coyote out here." "Oh, yeah." "And he's right there looking at you, you know, and down under the bush." He would be laying down with his, you know, snoot on the ground, but his eyes were open and checking out, and they'd say, you know, they would be wary, but then I'd sit down on the step and call him over. And he was pretty wary about it, but then he would come over and sit next to me. The people all really awestruck. And then I got to the point where if they were little kids, elementary school kids, I'd kind of whisper to them and say, "Would you like to hear him howl?" And their eyes would get big, like, "What do you have to do to that?" And I said, "Well, you and I are going to have to howl, and he'll join in." And they were kids for furry, but I could always get him going because I'd howl a little. And here I was, you know, the ranger in the flap hat,
right,
with a coyote sitting there, and I start howling, and I encourage, "Come on, Johnny, you got to do it with me." And they'd howl a little. And sure enough, thank goodness, Rusty would start howling.
Wow.
And that was such a positive experience for me. And mainly locals would come to see. And, you know, for them to see the coyote in these terms. Because
I just hate to carry this conversation on because, I mean, the whole reason why you got Rusty was because Rusty's mom was shot on sight, and that
right.
was the thinking of the day, was, coyote,
yeah.
where's my, you know, where's my Remington, where's my Winchester, we'll take care of this.
Right.
Okay.
But I put a big dog collar on him.
Ah, okay.
Which he, I said, "Well, that's so people can identify him." And it kind of works because the cowboys would come in and say, "I saw that coyote of yours. He was down off the road west of the monument a mile or so, and I didn't shoot it." And I'd say, "Oh, thank you."
Nice.
And the worst part was, or the best part, was that someone would come in a few minutes later and say, "I saw that coyote of yours. He was about a mile and a half east of the monument."
Wow.
"Just a minute ago, and I didn't shoot him." And I would, I would look over under the bush, and there was Rusty. I said, this is good. I don't have any problem with giving two coyotes another day's life.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
But if you, the story, you know, the fun parts clarity. And then, if you think it's appropriate, I can tell one story about Gerdes, because I wasn't the worst one. He and his family, his wife and his two kids, boy and girl, that were probably middle school age or something, or out of, my one might have been in elementary, but a cattleman came by and had a colt in the back of his truck, and a relatively newborn. And I don't remember if he did it on purpose, but or if he just had business there and the colt happened to be in the back of the truck. But Gerdes and his wife, and especially the kids, came out just, oh, that's the cutest thing they've ever seen. Well, it was a dogie colt, which means that the mother had been killed. And it was a real problem, and they always tried. Obviously, they tried their best to raise a colt, but they had a very poor record of colts that were nursing, and the mother was killed. It was really hard to keep the colt alive. But
yeah,
long story short, the Gerdeses kept the colt, and it would always get out, and it actually survived and it thrived. And they worked out a deal where they bought it and registered it and everything. But this colt was obnoxious because it grew up in their garage.
Oh, my.
I had, you know, a box with a coyote outside my back door. They had a corner of the garage with blankets and quilts for the doggie colt. And it thought it was a member of the family.
Okay.
And one of the, and they, it was always getting out of their, they had a little pasture there that they put it in, but it figured out how to get out. And it would come up to greet the tourists. And there are several, more than one picture that I wish I could find, where I was working in the little visitor center there, and here would come the colt walking in the door.
And in the little trailer, in the 6x12 trailer?
In the little trailer, the colt comes in. And so I would, either Gerdes or I, or both, or mainly I remember myself, just I ended up with a broom there that I left by the desk, and I'd chase it out, and swatting it on the rear with the broom, and off he'd go dancing around. That was part of the game. But then I'd turn and look, and there'd be a whole line of tourists, each with their camera, and photographed the first photograph, the cute colt, then photographing it walking into the visitor center, then being chased out and yelled at by the
ranger with the hat.
With the hat, with the broom.
What was the colt's name?
Oh, I'd have to think about that.
Okay, and how did Rusty get on with the colt?
Not too well, because I fed, as he got older, I fed, he liked it when I'd feed him his bowl of dog food in the evening out in the back on the porch. But I'd fed him, and then suddenly he was in the kitchen and not too happy.
Hmm.
And I look out there, and there's the colt eating his dog food.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing, there were several geese and ducks and chickens that were mainly from the reach, the district headquarters over Zion was in Cedar City, and invariably the people over there, Park Service people, they would buy their kids chicks and ducks for Easter, babies.
Okay.
And of course, the chicks and ducks, they turned into chickens, roosters, and obnoxious geese. And so, they'll take care of those at Pipe Springs. So they, a few months after Easter, here would come the parade from Cedar City with these obnoxious that had been raised in their houses.
It sounds like food for Rusty to me.
It was. And he had, it amazed to me, the complete instinct that took over because he, I fed him everything he needed and he definitely had enough, but he'd figured out that those ducks were fair game in his book, in his universe. But, I'd find him, he'd bring them back to me, unfortunately.
Oh.
So it was usually, there was no hiding it, but he would sit down under a bush in the backyard, and first he'd look at that thing for a long time, like, okay, I killed it, but what do I do now? And then he would get down and he'd try and pull all the feathers off it, which was hysterical to see because he'd get a mouthful of feathers and spit them away. And then he would take a couple of bites, but he never really ate them. He had enough food. He knew that he was supposed to kill him, which was unfortunate. But in a sense, it was hard to make a strong case for these domestic ducks.
Right.
That were such a pain anyway, because they'd attack the visitors. Little kids, look at this goose.
Oh, I bet they would. They'd just come charging.
So, in a sense, I can tell now Joe Bolander's gone, long, long, long gone from this world. But the geese got so bad attacking the visitors' kids that they just started disappearing one or two every night.
Okay.
And I know that he was responsible for that. Just didn't want to tell the Gertis' daughter that these cute geese. But and then there was, I'll just tell one more story on the coyote and the colt. In the house that I was in, I remember one night there was a knock on the front door, a really loud knock that usually meant trouble, but I went to the door and opened it, and this was dark out, but it was the colt kicking at the door.
Oh, wow.
And when I opened it in, he just leaped in, and I had to leap out of the way. The problem for him was that it was a linoleum tile on the floor. And so he just all four legs skidding across trying to keep standing up. And there was a bifold closet there right in front of him. And he just smashed into that.
Oh, my gosh.
Floor to pieces. And then he ran around. There was a loop you could make from the kitchen, dining, living room. You could run around a circle, actually, and he did. And somehow the coyote got into it and was, I couldn't tell if he was chasing the colt or colt was chasing him, but I finally got him grabbed the colt, which you could do. He had a halter on, and I got him out the front door, and I told him, well, not to come back, but he didn't, fortunately. And I remember I had to call the maintenance guys in Zion and say, unfortunately, the bifold doors in the hall there were destroyed. And they said, well, how could you? They knew me, and, I wasn't a wild party person by any means. And they really wanted to know. And it's loud knocking at the door, I open door. Gertis's colt leaps in, flies across the living room and smashes into the door. And they just said, oh, we'll be over later today or tomorrow and replace it. And I could hear them all laughing away. And they knew exactly what my problem was.
That story must have made the rounds around the wood stove in the maintenance department at Zion.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Great story.
It was always, what's next in Pipes?
Did you hear what happened at Pipes?
A lot more going on here than there. A little later, the Gertis's moved. He got a position at some battlefield in Georgia. And my national, historic battlefield, whatever they're called, and Civil War battlefield.
Yep.
And they bought a little horse trailer, and they thank goodness took the colt, which was now a young horse.
Mm.
They were breaking him to ride, which I thought was going to be a thrill. But they all left, and just to mention that Rusty, that fall, ended up, he was maybe 6 months old, but he found a girlfriend, and he'd go out in the desert to the south there. Occasionally I'd see the two of them, because he'd always come back in the evening, and there'd be this female with him, and she was very weary, and she'd stand off a quarter mile away down there and dismayed that he would come loping up under the fence, come right up to the house and be petted by
and me. Sit down next to you. Yeah.
And sit next to me. And then I took his collar off, because I could see that I was hoping he would go out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just didn't see him for a while, and I later found that he had been killed on the highway. I don't think he was shot, but he was just south of the monument there, in the bushes, and looked to me, and it just, the carcass had been there for months, so to say, but I knew it was him, and he had been probably hit by a car.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is known as digressing.
No, this is incredibly important. This is just the sort of stuff that I'm looking for in these oral histories. Because it's real life. And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that Rusty changed you or impacted you. I want to know how.
Well, it's the same that any pet, dog or something, can really affect a person, because there's that interaction, that contact. And so he was a special pet. I had to admit that, yes, that's what he was, that I had, he wouldn't have been there if I hadn't saved him.
Right.
And the interaction was the same. I mean, he would come and when I whistled for him, and he'd come on his own when he just was time to go roam around the monument. I had dogs when I was growing up, but not for so many years, and it just showed me how much I appreciated it. And I knew I couldn't have a dog or a pet to take with me in the canyon.
Right.
I just didn't think that was appropriate to the dog or the canyon. And I just had a, you know, we bonded, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
In so many ways. And I just learned so much from him. The little things I remember now, the two dogs would go run around, and I usually avoided them, especially in the morning when I was doing the bird survey, because they could disrupt everything.
Right.
And but I remember so many times there'd be a little culvert under the driveway, maybe 8 or 10 inches around or so, or less than that, 6 inches, little culvert, several of them around where to the campground and everything. But I could see that the little dog would tear up a ground squirrel or a regular squirrel, and the squirrel would run over and dive into the culvert. The dog would run right up to it and start barking in the hole. He couldn't get in there or wanted to. But it was always interesting to me that the coyote would walk around to the other end of the culvert and sit there and wait. And he didn't, I never saw him catch one, but, you know, automatic. He wasn't going to sit there and bark at the end of the front end of the culvert. He was going where the squirrel might come out.
So very smart.
Yeah, he was very smart. I could tell his ability. The little dog got bitten by rattlesnakes twice.
Hmm.
Didn't learn after the first time. Rusty never was. I could tell when he had something like that because he was up and he'd kind of jump straight up and down like you'd think a fox would jump.
Mm, uh-huh, uh-huh.
But he was off. He would stand back. He knew that was dangerous, and you just, I hoped he knew that you don't attack that's not a good thing there, the rattlesnake.
Did Rusty go after rabbits? Would he take down a rabbit?
I'm trying to think.
I'm thinking of cottontails or jackrabbits?
There were plenty around. I bet he did, but he didn't bring any into the compound there and didn't bring it to my backyard.
Okay. He didn't bring any home. Hmm.
Didn't bring any home.
Okay.
That's an interesting question because I don't recall.
Okay.
And, you know, I acknowledge that that cannot be done today.
Right.
And the main problem when I saw the two pups is there was no fishing game in the Arizona Strip. There was no one you were going to call. No one was going to rescue these pups the way it's so popular on TV today.
But what's fascinating is you were raising to reintroduce. And you weren't raising to contain or control. That's a big difference.
Right.
And so you were sort of on the cutting edge of that.
Yeah.
With your door always open, and eventually, you know, Rusty starts, you know, interacting with the bigger coyote world, and you've got an open door to that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and change it really changed the perception of lots of the local people, because anytime in Fredonia or Kanab, people, you know, relatives would visit, they'd bring them to Pipe Springs because that was their history.
Okay.
They had ancestors there, and everyone, and now they knew you won't guess what the Rangers got out there, and they had fun.
Nice.
My wife, the second fall I was there, my wife-to-be moved to Fredonia and got a high school teaching job, and it was very, well, we roared at it constantly, because that fall, the church groups from, even though we were not Mormon at the time, the young adult groups in Moccasin and Fredonia, where it was rare that they didn't have some kind of activity on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all, Sharon and I were always invited. I was invited by the one group, and she was invited by the Fredonia group. And we could see what was going on right away, because we were the only two single young adults in the country. And they had good designs. And so right away, you know, we got along and we were very compatible, and we enjoyed the activities and we really liked the people. And so it was, well, you know, I'll pick you up to go to this activity, and you can pick me up to go to that activity. And then one thing led to another, and a year later we got married.
You know what? I'm going to want to know more about Sharon here. We've been going for a little over an hour.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series.
It is. And, you know, I still haven't got Howard Mitchell down there.
Well, it'll happen, but I'm in no rush, and I learned a whole bunch of things today. This is great.
Yeah.
Super. Okay. Is there anything else you want to add about the material we've just covered?
Oh, there'd be hundreds of things, but I think it sums up some of the interesting, you know, where I was, what I was doing.
Yes.
And I'd say that the only thing I'd add is the people at Moccasin and Fredonia were very welcoming. And they, you know, I was just part of the family. They accepted me, and I was happy to be around them, and that's what was coming. It's just,
nice.
I fit in.
Okay.
Good.
Wonderful. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 6 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoy this.